When a compliance officer for the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration appeared at the Didion Milling Facility deep in the Wisconsin interior, Cambria, Wisconsin, about an hour north of Madison, perhaps the officer could hardly have believed his eyes. Metal sheets peeled back, walls blown off the side of the mill, structural steel dangling in tangles, stripped of its concrete. Nearby, a rail line ran adjacent to the facility, and its rail cars were knocked off its tracks, lying on their sides. And where the mill used to be, a pile of debris lay scattered about, tumbled down as if from an earthquake. But this was no earthquake. This was the site where, a day earlier, on May 31st, 2017, five workers died and several others were severely injured when the corn mill exploded due to a buildup of combustible grain dust. How did that inspection progress so that it led to criminal convictions for the company and several of its executives? These are the questions we'll ask during this episode of the OSHA 3030. I'm Manish Rath, and welcome to the OSHA 3030. Well, as I said, I'm Manish Rath. I'm an attorney here at Keller and Heckman, a law firm in Washington, D.C. For almost 30 years, my practice has focused exclusively on representing management in the field of occupational safety and health law, amongst other areas. I'm very fortunate today. I'm joined by my good friend, Taylor Johnson, and colleague here at Keller and Heckman. Taylor?
Manish, thanks for having me as always.
Well, Taylor, I think we've got an important topic today, the Didion Milling case. And it is, it's more than just an OSHA case, I suppose, by now.
That's right.
Taylor, in all the years we've worked together, you and I have both often said that there's only a few elements in the Occupational Safety and the Health Act area of law where there's any potential for criminal liability. And we've covered one of them in our prior OSHA 3030s, and I encourage people to check that out. But that's sort of the field of the idea that an allegation that there's such an egregious knowing instruction to enter an area that is easily predictable to be an area of danger, and then it may in some cases lead to fatalities. But then there's this idea of a criminal liability for frustrating the investigation process by the agency.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting set of facts, and obviously a bit of a shocking, or at least not normal, conclusion to a lot of the cases that we've covered in the past.
Right. I remember reading the sentencing documents this past weekend.
Yeah.
And wrapping up, preparing for this program. I think it's a really important program for every safety and health professional, for every plant manager, and for executives at any employer.
I completely agree. So let's get into it. So what we're going to do today is we'll start with just the facts, the shocking facts, really, of the explosion at the Didion Mill. In terms of the standard, what standard we'll cover on today's program, it's going to be the combustible dust standard, as that you'll hear is a really contributing factor to this explosion. Then we'll get into the OSHA inspection. So OSHA's an examination during that inspection of Didion's logbooks and cleaning and maintenance schedules being a real operative fact in this case. And then the indictment. A grand jury was convened. There was an indictment against Didion and six of its executives, and then the sentencing that happened as a result of that. And then after going through all that, of course, we'll finish with what employers should do. Some practical takeaway action items from this case.
So with that said, let's get on with it. Let's talk about the background on combustible dust and explosions. This is a well-known phenomenon. It's been known and managed by responsible employers around the country for decades. Grain mills contribute grain dust during their milling process and during their handling process generally. Grain dust in grain mills can be generated in very large volumes, and the dust can accumulate on horizontal surfaces of any kind, tables, shelves, even the ductwork up near the roof line. And it also gets pulled into HVAC systems. There needs to be strong filtration systems, and the filtration and collection of dust needs to be robust enough to make sure that it manages the air quality inside, as well as capturing dust to prevent it from being emitted outside for environmental protection reasons. So a grain mill has to have a sophisticated air handling procedure. And the part of the problem, in addition to environmental protection, is the air quality for workers inside. And then another problem is food safety generally. Taylor, corn in particular, over 90, some reports would put it at 99% of our all corn handled at these milling facilities around the country don't go to food. They go to fuel and to livestock,
right,
to feed. But that 1% that goes to human food consumption, there is also clearly a food safety implication.
Sure.
And accumulated grain dust also, from the perspective of food safety, it can lead to mold or other infestations. So you have to have a robust management for grain dust. But the other problem is the potential for combustibility. And that's what happened at the Didion facility. There was a suspension of grain dust that was set off, and then it continued to set off additional explosions and just propagates throughout the facility.
Right. I think it was actually static electricity, right?
It's probably static electricity, yeah, because it was inside the air filtration system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so it's not as likely that machinery can create the spark necessary to set this off.
Yeah.
Although that could happen inside the facility.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good catch.
Frightening.
Right. So this fine dust, it does generate electrostatic negative charge, and that can set off the necessary spark for an explosion. OSHA has recognized this possibility for a long time. So for several decades, it has implemented the grain handling standards. The grain handling standards address a lot of hazards associated with grain, including workers would walk the grain in order to get it flowing. There's another hazard associated with grain where people could be engulfed either in the grain itself or in the dust cloud above it. There could be an asphyxiation hazard. But then there's this idea of combustible dust. And so, you know, there's hot work permitting associated with grain dust, grain handling, et cetera. So this is a well-recognized phenomenon. And where it comes to combustibility, combustible dust, the grain handling standards require a regular sanitation program and a written plan for sanitation for grain dust.
Right. That's the first, I think, requirement that, you know, you'll hear during the course of this program, is that written requirement to have this plan to control the dust. And then the next is that, these filter collectors or bag houses is another term, you know, they capture the dust, that are sort of designed to, you know, make it more manageable of an issue. Those filtration systems, those bag houses need to either be located outside of the facility, or they either need to be installed with a suppression system or explosion venting. So essentially
venting to the outside.
Yeah, vent and explosion to the outside. So those are the two requirements that are really relevant as we go through the facts of today's case.
That's right. And that's because there is this constant risk of combustible dust associated with grain dust. If the dust particle is sufficiently fine enough, grain dust is organic, so it is combustible. And if it's fine enough and it is dense enough, if you introduce a spark, it could conflagrate to all of the neighboring dust and continue to deflagrate on down the line. The problem with that is a small explosion has a sort of outer perimeter of wind that kicks up accumulated dust, and that gets kicked up into the air, and then that gets ignited. And so the deflagration is successive and can propagate all the way down ductwork or suspended in the air, and it can continue to resuspend additional settled accumulated dust and go all the way down a factory. And that's exactly what happened to Didion Milling, where initial explosion in the filtration system continued to deflagrate all the way down the factory and into the working area. And it was the resulting collective explosion was a massive explosion with massive force. And as we said at the beginning, Taylor, 5 people died in that explosion. Several other people were severely injured, permanent life-changing injuries. And it was just a tragic event that arguably was also an avoidable event. The standard requires a regular sanitation schedule and a written sanitation program that's sufficient to manage precisely this risk. And indeed, Didion Milling had a written sanitation schedule in place.
Right. They did have a written sanitation schedule in place. As we'll get to, whether or not that was accurately being updated and whether or not the recording of that was up to par is a different story, but it was in place.
And the subject of interest for the OSHA inspector.
Right, exactly. So when conducting the investigation, the OSHA inspector, which by the way was the next day, the very next day after the explosion, OSHA comes in and is examining this sanitation logbook. This logbook is a key fact in this case and how it was or not, you know, filled out. And then interviewed Spanish. We don't exactly know what happened during the interviews, but we know that they were conducted.
Whether those interviews pointed the compliance officer in the direction of asking for additional documentation or not is hard to know because those employee interviews are confidential. But it started with a walk around, and then it involved an examination of the sanitation logbook, because that would be the first thing you would look to in a grain handling facility that had an explosion. And then there were interviews. And then at some point during the inspection period continued along, the agency asked for email correspondences.
That's right.
And what we see happen after that is where this storyline gets extremely interesting. The supervisors were supposed to, so at the facility, Diddy and Milling, there are shift supervisors, there's a food safety supervisor, there's a plant manager, and you continue up to the level of a vice president. And so when you look at the correspondences that the OSHA compliance officer was examining, the story that he was able to pull out of this was that the master sanitation logbook should have been, the authoritative source as to when sanitation was conducted. But in addition, because this is in part a food manufacturer, they're making corn products for food consumption by commercial clients who are purchasing the product for application in final food products. They also had a third party auditor who came in annually, if I recollect,
yep,
and would conduct audits. And in part, the audits included an examination of the sanitation schedule and compliance with their own sanitation protocol.
That's right. And what OSHA was able to determine, and other, you know, agencies that investigated this as well, is that the supervisors were actually sharing the auditor's route that they were going to tour, you know, in the facility ahead of time, in order to clean those areas up ahead of schedule. So they were sharing the route. They were pulling workers from one location of the plant to another to make sure that they were cleaning that particular area. They were also shutting down normal operations so that, you know, the auditor would essentially see as little as possible when walking through the plant.
Or perfectly clean.
Exactly. Right. Or nothing. Yeah, right. Exactly. And so this sort of a combination of tactics here to kind of, I don't want to say fabricate an environment, but at least make sure that it is not exactly as it would go on a normal.
The allegation is clearly collectively that they were gaming the audit.
Exactly.
The outside auditors, third party auditors were coming in trying to do their best to issue a certification that says that that commercial buyers of this product were okay to buy the product based on the third party audit. And Diddy and Milling, it is alleged, was gaming that audit in those types of ways in order to get a clean bill of health and a certificate that they could show to their commercial clients. But the OSHA inspector found even more.
Yeah. So not only were they gaming the audit, but they were actually cooking the books, essentially. They were forging initials on a sanitation logbook to look like cleanings had been done, and then various backdating. So backdating sign-offs at the superintendent level, at the level above that, at the compliance manager's level. And so there was a series of emails here that kind of led the inspectors to believe this.
So these were the allegations the compliance officer made. And right. When they came to this conclusion that this was a reasonable allegation, they forwarded it under the Department of Justice. So now it's not just in OSHA's hands. It's sort of out of OSHA's hands and in the hands of the Department of Justice.
Yes.
The Department of Justice moved for the convening of a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
And when a grand jury convenes, that is maybe the most inscrutable element of the judicial process. So we don't know what the grand jury asked for, what evidence they examined, and we don't know which evidence formed the basis for their findings.
Right.
Ultimately, the grand jury handed down a recommendation that indictments should be issued. And we do know what some of the evidence that was in the indictment. That's how we can put together what the compliance officer saw and how that led from the compliance officer's OSHA inspection to the stage where there was an indictment handed down. So let's take a look at some of those.
That's right.
Here's one email, an allegation of an email in the indictment. Allegation number 90, or I should say, you know, the factual recitation number 90 in the indictment, stated that in February of 2016, so this is about a year and 4 months before the explosion, Lenz, who's one of the supervisors at the facility, attached the bag house log, the maintenance and sanitation log for the baghouse from December of 2015, so from 3 months earlier. So he attaches it to his email that he sends to some shift supervisors, Hess and Niemeyer, and he says there's 130 blank entries in the December log, and he shaded them in the log with red. And he wrote in his email to Hess and Niemeyer, the two shift supervisors, I need the red areas filled in and sent back to me. This is in February, he's saying, about the December log. The December log has to be contemporaneously entered. So in February to say, I need them filled in back in December and sent back to me.
Yeah.
He's asking them to basically backfill data.
Exactly.
Without probably regards to the accuracy of their recollections or, you know, whether, and thereby the accuracy generally of those entries.
Right. For 130, hard to think that they'd be able to.
It's also easier to imagine that if they had done the scheduled maintenance, they would have entered it and it wouldn't have been blank, because there were entries that were filled in and there were entries that were blank. And thus, the logical implication of a scrupulously maintained log is that the blank means that it wasn't done that day.
Right.
Okay. So that's one email. We're just going to give you some samples.
So next, one of those shift supervisors that was put on that email about, you know, about filling in the book, he emails someone else under him, quoting, and quote, to bring the MSS book up to date because it would be looked at during a food safety audit the next day, and then to leave the logbook on the supervisor's desk once completed. So you kind of get the carrying out of this initial order to backfill the log here, exactly how to do it and where to leave it.
Right. And so this is Messner writing to Niemeyer, and Messner is the food safety superintendent.
Right.
Niemeyer is one of the shift superintendents. So Messner arguably has a more senior position, and yep. He's instructing the shift supervisor, bring the sanitation log up to date because it's going to be looked at during the audit right. by the outside third-party auditors the following day. Yeah. And to leave the logbook on Messner, the food safety superintendent's desk, once it's completed. Once it's completed, meaning once you've brought it up to date
right.
in advance of an audit. And that was in October 2016, again, about a year and 6 months, 7 months before the explosion,
yep.
but in advance of an October audit. So it would have been maybe the last audit before the explosion.
Well, that's right.
So these are the kinds of emails that formed the basis of the indictment, criminal indictment. Grand jury is convened, takes a look at evidence of a very large body of documentation and witness statements that we will not be able to see. Again, grand juries being one of the most inscrutable elements of the judicial process. And it's referred to the grand jury, and they issue their recommendation for criminal indictments. Criminal indictments are issued, and this results in indictments against both the company, Diddy and Milling, and at least six management officials, three shift supervisors, the food safety superintendent, a vice president, and these involve nine criminal counts. The nine criminal counts involve an allegation of a willful violation of the OSHA Act, conspiracy to commit fraud, conspiracy to conceal violations and unsafe conditions, conspiracy to essentially to frustrate an agency investigation. The three shift supervisors were indicted, and an allegation was issued that they had obstructed justice by providing false and misleading testimony after the explosion. At least one of them, maybe two of them, were actually convicted in addition to the fraud counts of falsifying their testimony.
Right.
Okay. How did these turn out? It's an interesting outcome for the company and for these executives.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to start from the top, the vice president, Derek Clark, he was convicted of conspiracy to falsify the logbooks, false compliance certifications, and obstructing an OSHA investigation.
He received 2 years in prison.
Yeah.
And after that, a year of supervised release.
That's right. And the same can be said about the next person here, the environmental manager, Joseph Winch. Again, pleaded guilty, conspiracy to falsify compliance certifications.
But in addition, Taylor, he perjured himself during the trial.
He did. And so he also got 2 years in prison and 2 years of
supervised 2 years of supervised release.
Yeah, right. One extra for perjury, maybe.
I suppose. Yeah, these are significant sentences.
Yep. Yep.
What about the food safety superintendent, Sean Messner, whose email we just looked at?
Yes. So 2 years in prison and a year of supervised release, convicted of conspiracy to commit fraud and to falsify the sanitation.
I'm going
to
go back to the Messner email, if you don't mind. The Messner email to the shift supervisors says that normal missing tasks and superintendent sign-offs are present in the logbook.
Yeah.
It seems the way I would read that is that those normal tasks that were missing are now
not missing.
Not missing. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So where were we? That's Messner?
That's Messner. Yep. And then the shift superintendents, so Hess, Niemeyer, and Bright.
I would argue that they were instructed to do certain things.
Sure.
And that may not be the equivalent of being not guilty, but it certainly qualifies as lesser than instructing somebody to do something or doing it yourself without anyone instructing you.
I would agree. And I think you see that here in the sentencing. So as opposed to 2 years in prison, all three of these individuals pleaded guilty to felonies before trial and received a 1 year probation.
Okay. So they have a felony conviction on the record and they have 1 year probation. And with the substantial terms associated with probation, including fines, one of them was fined $2,000. But, you know, the other terms of probation, including the supervised probation, et cetera, no firearms, no drugs, drug testing, that kind of thing,
sure,
are likely to be associated with these probationary sentences. What about Didion, the company?
Yeah. So the company pleaded guilty to falsifying environmental and sanitation logs. They were sentenced to pay $10.25 million in restitution to the victims of the explosion.
Yeah, that's important. That's not a fine to the agency.
Right.
They were sentenced in a restitution sentence, which is a criminal remedy to pay the victims, total of 10.25. And I don't believe that was just the victims who died in the explosion. I believe that would also go to a larger number of people who were injured. Some of them, again, life-changing serious injuries.
Absolutely. And then in terms of the agency fine, that was $1 million. And then an additional 5 years of probation with special conditions related to oversight of Didion's operations in moving forward.
I would believe that the oversight of Didion's operations would have to be very intense or intrusive, because this is a company who allegedly had a demonstrated record of thwarting third-party audits.
Right.
So for the court to assign a third-party overseer, that overseer would have to have extraordinary powers assigned to it by the court in order to police against specific attempts to thwart his purview, his ability to view into the company, past any efforts to deceive him, to screen, to sort of give him a walk down the primrose path, as they did for years with auditors, allegedly. So that's the sentence against Didion. There's just no way in a criminal conviction against a company to imprison a corporation. It is a legal person as a fiction of law, but that's where it stops. The practicality is you can't imprison a company. You can't shackle the doors. You have to have remedies of this type, including the 5 years of probation, which may lead to more severe outcomes if there were subsequent violations, even though the probation or other alleged criminal violations in the future. So it's a fairly serious sentence against the company that resulted from pleading out. So that's how these criminal cases came out. I think it's, in many ways, I shouldn't be surprised, but I find it in many ways surprising that these six individuals plus the company, in the face of this terrible event, chose the route of testimony at trial that was alleged to be false mm-hmm. testimony, et cetera, and the mm-hmm. cover-up efforts with respect to the sanitation logbooks. I think that actually preceded the, in some cases, it was alleged that there was falsification of the logbooks well before the explosion. It wasn't a cover-up of how the explosion occurred. Some of the alleged cover-up events were occurring in October of the prior year. And I think that's important to note. But I still find all of that surprising when you consider the efforts involved in the cover-up activity that was being alleged in the face of a pending audit when compared to mere compliance.
Mm-hmm.
So in light of that, let's talk, Taylor, about what we think employers should do in light of these sentences, in light of the story of why the company and its executives did what they did and what became of their decisions.
Yeah. I mean, so the first is compliance and governance policies. I think not just, you know, at a smaller level, like, you know, have a policy for, you know, have your written compliance plan for the combustible dust standard, for example, but in general, you know, higher level compliance and governance. How are we going to interact with agencies? What is our, you know, normal, you know, policy and procedure for an inspection? Things like that, I think.
Yeah. And the checks and balances, I think, that should be written out in a written corporate governance policy, where there's checks and balances, where one arm of the company's function is to oversee another arm of the company, rather than working in concert with each other to collectively deceive a third-party auditor or a government agency.
Yeah.
So that checks and balances system should be baked into the written governance policy. We do a lot of reviewing corporate governance policies for just these things, if not to see whether or not they've written a policy that merely prohibits fraud. It is to see whether the written policy has structural checks and balances to catch, detect, and correct any attempts at fraud. And that, I think, is the critical element and the one that we look out for when we're assigned by clients to take a look at their governance policies.
That's right.
I think the second thing that involves training for managers, I think that this was a failure on the part of the vice president, the food safety and superintendents, the shift supervisors, where you would hope that better training for those individuals would have helped keep them from being led astray.
Right. And forever getting that behind in the logbook, right? I mean, you know, doctoring it after the fact is one thing, but, you know, apparently 130 days going by, for example, without, you know, having any entries, I think is something that you would look to training and sort of this top-down, you know, management to correct.
Yeah, so you're right, Taylor. There's a few things. You have to train the safety and health practitioners to run a better safety and health program. The food safety folks have to run a better safety and health, a food safety program. But in addition, you should train the managers on how to handle agency inspections, how to handle third-party auditors, training managers. And a third element is training managers on the importance of honest and integritous documentation and record keeping.
Right. Yep.
This idea of these alleged backdating and backfilling entries is something that every supervisor at the lowest level of supervisor responsibility upward should have to undergo rigorous training where they understand what the corporate values are and that the corporate values when it comes to honesty and integrity are inviolable. That, I think, that kind of training, maybe companies just take it for granted that everyone understands that, but I don't think that should be taken for granted. I think that training should happen, and there should be a record of the training and who attended it and maybe some kind of testing for comprehension on the concept.
That's right. And finally, in-house or outside counsel should certainly participate in responding to inspection requests, subpoenas, discovery requests, you know, and at all the stages here to have counsel present, I think, and this is certainly a lesson, a takeaway.
Yeah, I think that's important. We see a lot of production going on during OSHA inspections where we find out about it after the fact and then we're brought into the case.
Yeah.
And that production, that document production is a really critical part of the company's ability to manage its liability, its exposure to risk, legal risk. And so counsel should be involved, whether it's the in-house counsel or your outside counsel. That should not be happening without counsel's participation because of precisely the problems that Didion experienced during the agency investigation and onward through testimony at trial, et cetera.
Yep.
Yeah, really critical. I think that's a great point, Taylor. Well, that's the last word on this episode of the OSHA 3030. Taylor Johnson, as you know, all of our episodes for 10 years running now are housed on our website, khlaw.com/OSHA3030. And if you want to look at some of the prior episodes, including those relating to criminal liability and other related subjects, they're all found on our website, khlaw.com/OSHA3030. In between our monthly episodes, we also are available. This episode, as with all other episodes, will be republished as a podcast and on YouTube, which will be housed, a link will be housed on our website, khlaw.com. So check them out. But when you do, please remember to like or rate the podcast or the YouTube video so that they become more easily searchable in search results by others. So please leave the good word about the program for others to find. We are both available on LinkedIn. Please link in with us if you haven't already. If we shoot you a LinkedIn connection, keep an eye out for it and please accept it so that we can stay in touch. In addition, when you get the next invitation, as we often said, we're very grateful to those of you who have helped us out. When you get the email invitation for the next episode, please forward it on to at least three other people within your organization and your colleagues at other organizations down the street, within your profession, within your trade. Try and spread the good word about this podcast so that more people come to the program and we're able to keep it going, maybe for another 10 years. Thank you all very much for participating in this episode of the OSHA 3030. I want to thank the staff here at Keller & Heckman, Taylor Johnson and myself, both very grateful for all the help. And we look forward to seeing you all again next month, April 24th. And until then, stay safe.